Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Somebody, or more accurately, many, many somebodies, have gathered lots of information about you. Unless you've been living in a cave your whole life, you've been leaving a trail of information about yourself that someone has been dutifully collecting. Today on Midday, as part of Minnesota Public Radio's special series on privacy, the Surveillance Society, we're going to try to find out more about what those somebodies might know about you, who those somebodies actually are, and how they collect all this information. Joining us today from Washington is Ari Schwartz, who is policy analyst for the Center for Democracy and Technology, an organization which has been tracking privacy issues, and which today is launching a new website called Operation Opt Out, to help consumers remove their names from the ubiquitous lists that are being compiled by marketers, the government, and those other somebodies. Also with us is Don Ray, a Los Angeles-based author and independent journalist who spends his time digging up information about people and who has written several books and articles on how people can protect themselves from the somebodies out there gathering personal information. As always, we invite you to join our conversation. We're talking this hour about privacy, who's gathering information about us, where do they find it, and what can they find out about us? Give us a call here if you'd like to join our conversation. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Gentlemen, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Morning, Jerry.
Ari Schwartz, let me start with you. Who is gathering all these bits of information about us? Is it just the marketers? Is there some kind of government cabal at work here? What's going on?
I think it's a little too simplistic to say that there's some sort of government cabal going on, but certainly there are large groups of marketing organizations out there. There are these new companies called data miners or profilers that collect this kind of information about individuals and keep it in a centralized location, sell that information. And then we have all of the financial institutions as well that, along with the new financial modernization bill, which was just signed into law last week, can now put together all sorts of information with the new company as these new companies merge, insurance companies and banks, credit card companies, et cetera, can now tie all this information together in ways that was never before possible.
So theoretically, like the new financial institutions, if you had a bank and an insurance company put together, they could take a look at your what your medical situation was and decide whether they'd give you a mortgage on that basis?
That's a possibility for the future, yes. Then again, we also have the new people. There are these companies, the data mining companies, that can sell information about your online surfing habits, and as that's tied to offline information. And in fact, some of these online tracking companies have bought some of the offline companies. So we're talking about more and more aggregation and more tracking. And then there are also some government plans to do a little bit more tracking as well to try and prevent terrorism and some of other major concerns, which we feel also could lead to greater surveillance, government surveillance down the road, especially as all this information gets aggregated.
Now, Don Ray, I think many people, when they talk or think about this subject, connected directly to computers, the online age, the internet, and the rest, but looking over some of your material, it seems pretty clear that people have been leaving a fairly detailed, lengthy trail, even if they've never gotten close to a computer. I mean, if they apply for a rabies shot for their dog or register to vote, if they've had a baby, all of these things create a paper trail, do they not?
It's true, and they always have, and that's the reality to it, that the government has been keeping records for a long time, and the public has had the right to inspect those records and make sure that my dog got a rabies shot and yours didn't, or vice versa. I think what Ari says is correct, that it's really the technology that's causing the problem now, the fear, the paranoia, you might say, in that now these records that have been around forever are starting to be better combined. The data mining is a good example of that. You've gathered all together in one place, and all of a sudden it becomes very, very valuable.
So computers have not materially changed what's being collected. It's just made it a lot easier to collate and cross-reference. Is that right?
Well, you know, I'm going to say that with regard to public records, those things that I believe every citizen needs to be able to inspect to make sure government's functioning properly, those there are actually fewer of those available now than there were in the past. And they eventually went on to computers, but it's the computerization that makes it easier to get to. In some cases, I think Ari will agree with me that the technology has allowed them to say, hey, let's look for information in places that it wasn't there before. Let's scan your buying habits, your viewing habits. As you walk through a grocery store at one chain in Los Angeles, they have a computer on the cart that actually tracks where you walk. Well, that's new information, and it's how they use it that gets a little bit scary.
So it has changed the problem qualitatively, not just quantitatively, if you will.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Ari Schwartz, do most companies sell or share the information they collect, or can a consumer reasonably expect that when they're doing business with Company X, that Company X is the only company that will have access to and in some way use the information you give them?
Generally, companies do sell the information or use the information, at least internally, in other ways than it was originally collected for. Now, recently, there's become more of a practice of posting privacy policies onto websites. This doesn't happen in the day-to-day real world. You don't get to examine what's going to happen to your information. But at least on the web now, there's a little bit more information. People can find out what the company is going to do with it. And if they disobey that, the FTC has made it very clear that the company disobeys its policy, that is fraud. So you can, to some degree, trust these privacy policies on websites, at least in terms of buying on the Internet. Now, we've also been working on trying to make these easier to read, make it so that the browser can read them automatically, trying to automate this process, to use technology to help individuals make these decisions on their own. But again, that's further down the line. Right now, you still have to read all the legal text.
But there is some legal protections already available to protect people if they don't want their information shared?
Well, only if the company posts a privacy policy. Company does not post a policy, they can do whatever they want. But that's a way of a trust mechanism there that, you know, you can ask your company for their policy. If they don't have a policy, you can say, well, then I'm not going to do business with you. Or if the policy says we're going to do whatever we want with your information, you can make that decision. But there are not other stronger protections out there about what those policies can say, and that's what we and some other groups in Washington are working on right now to try and get some baseline protections put in.
Don Ray, how should we conceptualize this? Should we think about this as somebody sitting somewhere with a big file on us?
Well, you know, I'm one who says you should use some reason in here. There's certainly some benefits and advantages to allowing companies to have information or cookies in your computer or whatever. We all tend to use it to our benefit. It's just that when we fear that someone's using it for information for purposes that we don't like them to use it, that we have problems with it. I tend to think that we need to take a reasonable view of this and say, wait a minute, the potential is out there. My rule, my personal rule is don't give out information about myself unless I know where it's going. And I'm pretty safe with that one. Figuring that this touches every family in the nation, it means that the crooks have that many more people to go after, and indeed those who are sought after should be worried about it. I think that it's a paranoia that is a little bit beyond what it should be. I think that with any other technology, when we learned to drive cars, we learned about locks, and we learned to roll up our windows, and we learned to be careful where we park them and where we put our keys. I think a lot of that it needs to be done with this information, as well as giving the consumer the option of opting out, which is the key. But then that puts it on the consumer, and to this day, in this day of paranoia, I still watch people going into restaurants and dropping their business cards into a fishbowl thinking they'll get a free lunch. That whole idea of free lunch is really tempting to people.
Explain.
Well, the...
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it is that it's the same thing. Whether you give the information away with the registration of your software or you give the information away by simply going to a website that can track where you're going, here you walk into a restaurant, you plop your card into this bowl. If you think that they're just dying to give you a free lunch, that's crazy. They want the names of the customers. They want to know who's coming there. If you use your credit card, they can easily match up your credit card information with your business card and be able to, with your credit report, to find personal information about you and link it to your profession and have an idea of how much money you make. Then they know who to send the free coupons to or the pretty offers to.
Hmm. Ari Schwartz is with us, a policy analyst for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Don Ray is with us. He's a Los Angeles-based author and independent journalist. And we're talking this hour about what information is being gathered about people, who's doing it, and just how they go about it. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. I think many people were brought up with the belief that the one number they should protect under all circumstances is their Social Security number. Is that the holy grail of information collectors?
Well, in some ways, the Social Security number has become an imperfect identifier. In some ways, that's fortunate because we Americans do not want a national ID number. But in some ways, that's unfortunate because it's so easy to get people's Social Security numbers that they're not really a good way of identifying who an exact individual is.
So it's not, if somebody has your Social Security number, you shouldn't freak out about that, that a lot of people have it, and probably it's not going to cause you any trouble?
Well, there's this question of letting it spread out, how far you want to let it spread out, but in some cases you have to turn it over. If you're going to get, if you're applying for credit, you don't give the person your Social Security number, you're not going to get the credit. There's no other way to look up individuals. You have the right not to do it, but they have the right not to give you credit because you haven't given your Social Security number. In other circumstances, you can refuse to give your Social Security number as an identifier, nothing may happen to you because of it, and it certainly is legal not to give out your Social Security number.
Don Ray, is there one piece of information that people should be particularly protective of, or is it the total mosaic, really, of information that causes the trouble?
Well, unfortunately, if we're talking about the people who are out to do you in, so to speak, they need very little information. We just need what we call a hook, meaning a date of birth, a good address, a correct spelling of the name with the middle initial or the middle name, a Social Security number, sometimes a phone number. Any of those will be an on-ramp to get you on this information superhighway about people, the personal superhighway. And unfortunately, as Ari says, the credit reports are linked to the Social Security number. So once you find a good address or a good date of birth or a good identifier, then by going to publicly available, which are commercial services, these credit companies, they're literally legally allowed to sell the non-financial information about you from your credit report, which means that when somebody finds your address, your date of birth, your name, they'll then learn your Social Security number, and then by running the Social Security number through the credit bureaus, they'll be able to find out everywhere you've lived from as far back as 20 years ago, and the names of anybody else that was using your credit card or rather your Social Security number as a co-applicant for a loan or something like that. So it's so readily available to those who know how to do it. And it has been this way, by the way, for many, many years, that I think Social Security number is the one crucial thing. And I think another suggestion is to simply be less specific about your name. I'm Donald Philip Ray, and Philip has one L. Well, if I put down Donald Philip Ray on every place I put my name, it's real specific. It's going to be easier to find me. But if I put down Don Ray or Phil Ray or DP Ray, it slows it down. And I think the answer here is to find ways of slowing down, making it less convenient for people to go after you.
Let's get to some callers here. Don Ray is with us. He's from Los Angeles. He gathers information about people and also provides information to people as to how it is that they may avoid having information gathered about them and what's actually being collected about people. Ari Schwartz is with us. He's with the Center for Democracy and Technology. The center is just posting a new website today, opening a new website called Operation Opt Out, designed to help consumers remove their names from lists that are being compiled. We're talking about privacy and what people can find out about you. If you'd like to join our conversation again, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. First caller's from Hibbing. Bill, go ahead, please.
Give my call. I'd like to just tap on a couple of things that you haven't mentioned, such as telephone records. Somebody keeps a record of that at the phone company of all the calls you've made. I'd like to mention to viewers, there's a movie that's right about what we're talking about. It's called Enemy of the State. It talks about the NSA, which some people are familiar with, and you mentioned government cabal. NSA has been empowered by the technology to store more information. Storage capacity is virtually unlimited, and you can get it into a very small space. Phone call, every phone call can be monitored with the storage capacity in fact, if you want to find out the number I'm calling from, I'm calling on an 800 number. You have a type of a what we call a caller ID there that tells you where this number has come from. So that puts up a red flag. Somebody calls in on this issue, and somebody wants to go through your records and look at who has an interest in this issue, and they may be checking out certain books from the library, books that you check from the library go through. They're there in that, encoded into that total scan of who you are, the social security number, the required to get college loans, the required to get into college. It's one of those information that is required. If you refuse to give this, your loan may be denied, your admittance to college may be denied. There's your selective service registration. If you have a social security number, well, then you are beholden to the selective service to be registered.
Okay. Well, let's get some comments here,
excellent.
Bill.
Thanks a lot. I'll hang up.
Okay.
The caller brings up a very good point about how some of these features get built in, that we start collecting more and more information. I mean, the NSA and the FBI have been pushing for greater and greater surveillance. But in the process of doing that, they've also expanded the amount of information that's collected about individuals, and they have plans to do even more collection. They've recently pushed the FBI has recently pushed the FCC to track location of cell phone users, so all cell phone users will be able to be followed based on where they're making their calls from and where their phone is on from. And conference calls. If you're on a conference call with someone that's a suspect, you can be followed after the conference call. And NSA, there was an article in the Washington Post this weekend about NSA's echelon system, which is doing much more tracking about surfing habits, about messages that are posted on the internet, telephone calls, etc. So as this expands, we're more and more information is being collected. Some of it gets out into the private sector. Some of it is collected for one purpose and then used for another purpose within the government. All things that Americans have always been afraid of in terms of the Big Brother concerns.
You know, I'm not so certain that people have always been afraid of it. Not to say there isn't reason to be concerned, but indeed, I've been driving around for 30 years with my license plate on my car, and long before that, we used to have our registration right on the steering column, meaning anyone could walk up and find out who we were. We put our names on our mailboxes and our doormats, and we had our phone numbers listed in both phone directories and city directories, and we didn't have a problem. So one has to question what has changed. A few crimes that we in the media are guilty of overblowing, maybe. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's really not, in my opinion, unless you're doing something wrong or you're incredibly wealthy and vulnerable, I don't think that the FBI or the NSA has the resources, even with the computers, to want to monitor my every move. And since I don't do anything I think they should care about, I think it's a waste of their time. Let them follow me. By the way, I want to point out, Bill made a good point about all these records that might be used. He mentioned libraries, and it's real important to point out on behalf of the American Librarians Association that these folks are the most vigilant folks you'll ever see in fighting the FBI, and they've gone to court over this, preventing any government agency from tracking anything you read or books you check out or whatever. Unless you're late getting your book in which you violated the law and you pay a fine, they're going to fight to make sure nobody can do that one. So I want to put people's mind at ease about going to the library.
Well, that brings up another point, though, and that is that even if the government is not collecting some of this information, isn't it true that with a simple subpoena, they could collect information that other people have collected?
That's absolutely right, and that gets at the point that I was trying to make, that we have had the Fourth Amendment, which protects our information within our homes, but now that so much more of this information is moving to the networked environment, it's being held by third parties, it's not being held by us. The FBI doesn't need to come to us anymore to get our information. They can go to the internet service provider, they can go to the banks and get this information simply through a subpoena. So there has been a significant shift, but I would disagree with Don and say that, you know, we have had the Fourth Amendment. We do have some privacy concerns that have been with this country since its founding.
Let's go back to the phones. Andy's on the line with a question. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi, I have a question and a comment. The question is, as far as this the internet access thing, are they actually able to track exactly what websites you visit? And the comment is, I used to work in a computer lab. And in that lab, I witnessed many people who would accidentally misspell a website. For instance, whitehouse.org sends you to the White House website. Whitehouse.com sends you to, well, porn. And another example is a search engine, Excite. E-X-C-I-T-E. Well, if you type in E-X-I-T-E, once again, you get to a porn site. So if you make these mistakes, suddenly it's on record that you visit these sites. Is that something somebody can hold against you? Or are they going to understand that you might have just made a mistake?
Okay.
It's not illegal to view those websites. If you go to whitehouse.gov, you're going to see the White House. If you go to org or to com or to one of the other, EDU even, I think you're going to get a variety of humorous things and some porn stuff. You know, it's the person who downloads the information that the FBI will come after. Actually, even upload is really more appropriate. Those who send, for example, photographs of children involved in sexual things, it's the people who post them to the internet or ship them who are the ones that are under investigation. And again, I don't think that, since this is so common, as you point out, Andy, so many people are stumbling across this, that I don't see the real potential for someone coming in and saying you're a pervert because your computer went to this site. If you downloaded 20 minutes worth of information, maybe it's a different story. But even then, I disagree with anybody who says it's okay for them to be watching you.
Mm-hmm. What about, how does this tracking procedure work?
Well, there are different ways of tracking. There are the basic web logs, which give a certain amount of information, basically what kind of computer you're on, they can tell what service provider you're coming from in a lot of cases, what country you're coming from. But then there are also these profiling companies, mostly the ad banner networks, that set tags onto your computer, and these tags are usually either what are called cookies, which is basically a number that that identifies you, or a web bug, which is a clear graphic that's set onto your computer as well, that so you don't really realize that you're being tracked. In either case, unless you have your cookie, there's something on your browser that you can set to alert you when cookies are being set. But if these are being set by an ad banner company that's on two different sites, they can track you across the sites, whereas usually the site itself can only track you within the site.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ISPs also sometimes keep a record of where individuals go to, although they purge those records, and every ISP does that differently.
So if you guys, each of you had advertising on your site, and I clicked on, first of all, to the Center for Democracy and Technology, theoretically, if you had the advertising, it could pick up the fact that I was looking at your site and then follow over as I went over to Don Ray's site, and then they would put together a little booklet about me?
If it's one of these profiling ad banner companies, they do that. Usually they don't tie it to personally identifiable offline information, but now a lot of, at least one of the bigger companies, DoubleClick, has bought an offline marketing company, and they can actually tie that to some of your offline habits as well.
So it wouldn't be just a question that my computer was looking at your website, but eventually they could find out it was me?
They could find out if you turned over information to one of the sites showing that it was you, if you bought something on one of the sites, they could certainly, they have the ability to do that. Right now they say that they don't do that, and you can opt out, and that's one of the reasons we built this opt-out site, although we don't think that's the end answer. We think that but you can get off, and you can get off this list right now and stop the information from being shared.
We're talking this hour about information that's been collected and is being collected about people, just how much information is being collected, who's doing the collecting, and how they go about collecting the bits of information that they do have. Our guest this hour, Ari Schwartz, who is with the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. Don Ray is with us. He's in Los Angeles. He's an author, an independent journalist who spends his time gathering information and letting people know how it is that this information is gathered and what you might do about it. This is all part of our series. All week long, we're going to be looking at the issue of privacy. And if you'd like to join our conversation this hour, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to some more callers in a couple minutes.
This winter, Garrison Keillor and the cast from A Prairie Home Companion are back from New York for a run of 6 live broadcasts at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. NPR members, order your tickets now before they're on sale to the general public next week. Call Ticketmaster at 612-673-0404 or stop by the Fitzgerald box office and get your member discount. It's 6 new shows live in downtown St. Paul this winter.
By the way, an invitation to join us second hour of our program today. We're going to hear from Kenneth Starr, former independent counsel, who spent 5 years investigating what started off to be the Whitewater controversy, of course expanded then into the Lewinsky affair and the rest. Law itself was allowed to expire. The independent counsel law was allowed to expire last summer. Kenneth Starr thinks that's a good idea. He said there were some fundamental problems with the law was set up, but he also has some things to say about his own investigation of the president. I think you'll be interested to hear what he has to say, and we will hear from Kenneth Starr over the noon hour today. And we're talking this hour with Don Ray and Ari Schwartz about information that's being collected by information collectors, information about you, personal information. Who's doing the collecting, what is being collected, and what you might do to restrict what happens with that information. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Jason, go ahead, please.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'll make this short because I'll probably cut out.
Thank you.
My call has to do with, you said that the government does track people who download information from specific sites. My question would be, what about these people that download the information and then send it out via emails to a number of individuals who had no interest in this site? I receive emails periodically that I don't even know who the people are who are sending them to me, but the information is obviously something I wouldn't be interested in. How would that be affected? Are those people tracked as well then?
Gentlemen?
Well, this is Don. I don't have the knowledge of the government standing by and watching every move everybody makes. I know one of the stories I'm working on is about an operation the FBI did about pedophiles on the internet, which is a real, real big problem. And the sad part of it is that if you looked at the policy of the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, and this is a good example of how they track, they were able to identify thousands of people who downloaded, let's say, kiddie porn or pictures of children that were inappropriate. And, of course, there's apparently no crime or it's not terribly enforceable about the downloading, but it's the sending of it. And of those that they sent, the controversy that went all the way to Congress is that the FBI was not enforcing it. The U.S. attorney was not actually filing on anybody. They didn't have the desire to file where they might not win, so they made a two-upload rule. And then when the local police said, hey, if you've identified a pervert, a pedophile in our area, you should let us know. And the FBI refused to give the information even to the local authorities. So I don't see a great organization that's efficiently watching every citizen and what they're doing. I don't think there's the manpower. Imagine sitting in the Rose Bowl and talking to your neighbor. Well, if someone could monitor every conversation in the Rose Bowl, where would they have the people to man all of the monitors is my question.
Let's go on to another caller here. Tisha's on the line from Lutzen. Go ahead, please. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. The reason I'm calling, I recently moved to Minnesota, and I was surprised to discover that when I applied for my driver's license in Minnesota, that the information I gave them could be used by marketers unless I checked a box on the reverse side of the driver's license application.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know if most people would be aware that you'd have to check the reverse side because there's nothing on the front that indicates that there's any information useful on the back.
Right. Ari, is that fairly common?
Yeah, that's a very common practice, actually. That first of all, it's very, very common that information from driver's license, from the driver's license database, and there's a Supreme Court ruling on this, although it's kind of more of a state's right issue about whether the federal government can make a limit, their sale of the information. But that's also part of our new opt-out website is we list all of the different offices that you can write to opt out from the sale of information. So you don't need to just do it when you're registering. You can do it at any time. And people that don't want their information sold to marketers, the information that's on their driver's license, they should think about doing that because that's really the only protection they have right now.
Is it too late? Have we already gone so far down this path that any efforts to block further disclosure is kind of futile?
Well, I don't think it's too late because people move and the information does change and so people do still have the ability to make changes, and a lot of the marketers and other people will purge their databases after a period of time. And that's also one of the problems here. Some of them don't purge the information; a lot of it's incorrect, and people have no way of actually correcting it. So I don't think that it's that people opting out now it's too late. I think that it's really something useful that people can do.
Don Ray, should everybody have a shredder at home?
No, I don't believe so at all. Again, I know records very well. For 30 years, I've been tracking people down for legitimate purposes, and I have no angry people, anyone who's angry at me for what I've done. And the key is you can shred all you want. The question is, can you go back and change it? Well, unfortunately, you generated a public record the day you were born. In most states, that's public record. And marriage records are public, and property records are public, and in most states, voter records are public, and this is essential. So what the real question I want listeners to ask themselves is, how do they want the government to function? Do they want to have everything in secrecy, and then the pendulum will fall to where the son of the mayor won't have to be paying property taxes, or the son of the president will get to vote five times or whatever, because we can't inspect the records? I think it's essential that the government records remain available to the general public. A good question is, should government agencies be able to sell in bulk the information about me to commercial endeavors and marketing people? And I have some serious problems with that. It boils down to, unfortunately, it's buyer beware, and the word opt is so important when you talk about opt out, is you've got to say, okay, I want the privilege of driving. Now, where's this information going to go, Mr. DMV person or whatever? I want the privilege of voting. What can I do to limit it? People need to be much more vigilant about where the information is going. I want to point out something really interesting, and I think Ari will help me on this one. Jason mentioned dialing in to a website and getting the wrong one by accident. I just tried to go where I thought Operation Opt Out would be, and I went to www.optout.org, thinking it would be a nonprofit, and ironically, and this is a hoot, the people who have optout.org is the Aristotle Company, and they're in the business of selling voter registration records across the country. So I was hoping maybe that Ari could give me a better website.
That's right. Well, if you go to cdt.org, www.cdt.org, you'll see links to the Opt Out website.
Great.
There.
CDC?
CDT, Center for Democracy and Technology, yeah.
Thank you.
Do these electronic records, tracings, cookies and all that, do they ever disappear, or are they always there? In other words, we hear a lot about email. Well, it never really disappears at all. Do these other things disappear, or?
Well, some of the cookies are expire after a period of time, but the information on the back end, the information of where you've surfed, et cetera, is held as long as the database companies want to hold it for, or the companies that are collecting this information want to hold it for.
So if somebody does something foolish at some point in their life, they are subject to having that called back and held up to them pretty much forever?
Well, that's, I mean, this is one of the problems that's out there. I'm not sure that, I think Don's done, has explained very well the certainly why public records need to be open, and why, law enforcement has been looking into this information up to this point, to show that, you know, that it makes sense, to have these kind of records out there. But then again, there are also are these news group lists. Deja News collects everyone's postings, anyone that posted to a news group on the internet, which can be looked up at any time. So something that someone wrote when they were 15 could come back to haunt them when they run for office at 35. That's just a fact of the way that the internet functions, that it is easy to archive. But we also have to become a society that is willing to tolerate, things that people said and understand that people made mistakes in the past.
Larry, your question, please. Larry?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, it's a three-part question. Number one is specifically, who do you have to give your Social Security number to? Number two is specifically, who do you not have to give it to? In other words, companies that say, I need it. And is it illegal for them to demand it? And thirdly, is it ever illegal to give a false security, Social Security number? Like an example would be me taking a community college course in woodworking or so, and they want my Social Security number. Is there any illegalities in giving that to a company of that nature?
You know, I just I lost my Social Security card, so I had them send me a new one, and I read the notice that's now on all new Social Security card on the part you throw away when you tear it off. Actually, it says to keep it. And basically, it's a disclaimer by the federal government saying, hey, people may ask you for your Social Security number, and while it's not illegal for them to ask for it, it may not be required that you give it, and they say that some state laws or some local laws will require it, and it's up to you, basically, the Social Security says, to ask them if it's required, and I will even add to that, ask them to cite the law or the court ruling that requires it, and then you make your choice on that one. But Social Security indeed says, and I believe they're pretty good about this, that indeed nobody in Social Security is going to provide the information to marketing people about your Social Security information. They've been pretty strict about that stuff.
They have been. In fact, they don't like the burden that they've been given of having this kind of national identifier in their shop. There is a federal law, the Privacy Act of 1974, which limits the spread of the Social Security number. Specifically, any new databases that do use Social Security numbers within the federal government have to be very specific why they need the Social Security number. And as Don said, you can ask federal agencies to do that. Same with state governments. State governments are allowed to ask for it by law. No private company can force you to ask for it, but they can deny you services for not giving it to them.
And Larry, in answer to your third question, I have a friend who is very, very dyslexic. And he has such a problem whenever he goes to do a Social Security number that he somehow swaps two numbers. Now, gosh, I think it's all an innocent accident, but he just wonders maybe they can't track him also.
All of this seems like so much work. Why is it that there isn't a law that says nobody can use any of this information without you giving specific approval?
That is something that we have worked on a number of fronts, most recently in the bank modernization bill. I think that it makes a lot of sense, particularly in the instance of financial institutions and with medical information, except for in certain circumstances when obviously doctors do need the information directly. But it makes sense to put those kind of limits on certain kinds of information.
I think it's going to be interesting when somebody passes a law somewhere that says, and some people have suggested this, that, sure, use my information, but pay me each time you sell it. I want a commission. I think we're going to see people reversing and rushing to fill out warranty cards.
John, you're next. Go ahead, please.
I have a friend who couldn't remember his Social Security number, so he guessed, and it was wrong, and it was on his tax form, and he complained to me about it because he couldn't get his refund. So I told him to go to the IRS and tell them what he did. So the funny thing about it is now he's got two Social Security numbers, the real one and the phony one, because for some bureaucratic reason, they cannot undo a Social Security number, even if it's a fake Social Security number. And I guess my question is, you think that the reason I don't believe that we will ever have a flat tax is because the IRS, I believe, is primarily an intelligence gathering organization? Do you think that idea is a wrong idea?
Gentlemen?
Well, I don't give them that much credit. I do a lot of training to law enforcement groups and government groups on public records. And I find that even the police, when I'm giving them a basic course on public records, by the way, I endorse them using public records before they violate Fourth Amendment rights. Go to the public sector and get it. But what happens is of all the groups of people who you would think would be very proficient at this, law enforcement is way down at the bottom of the list on their ability to use this kind of information on computers effectively.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller here. Dorothy? Quick question.
Hi. Yeah, a couple things I wanted to say. One was, as a matter of fact, Minnesota Public Radio sold its membership information to the Democratic National Party. It's not a commercial venture, but it did violate our privacy, and they said they won't do it anymore. But I'm wondering how frequently that is done by public radio stations across the country. And my second question was, one of your guests mentioned warranty cards, and can you explain about that a little bit?
Okay, let's take those in opposite order. Warranty cards.
Okay, if I may, and I'm sure Ari has more knowledge of this than I do, but basically, you buy a VCR, and you get this card that comes with it, and they try to give you the impression that you must fill it in and you must send it in order for your warranty to be good, which from all of my knowledge, I'm sure that your warranty is good if you never fill it in. But look at the questions they ask. I did an experiment recently, about 2 years ago, where I took a warranty card and I basically made up a name of someone who didn't exist. And I made it look as if I had gotten married, and I hyphenated this name with my last name. And I let her fill this fake person. I let her fill in the information. She liked sewing. She liked tennis. She wanted another career somewhere, et cetera, and all these what do you like to do things. And I tracked the junk mail she got for the next 2 years based on filling out that warranty card. And it was incredible. For every box you check on that thing, these people are going to sell the information to the appropriate industries or magazines or marketing people that can use it. It's astonishing. So the mere filling it in sends it in, and you're on record with them, which could be good if there's ever a product failure or a safety issue with the product. But when you fill in the other information, you're handing it to them on a silver platter. The one box I like the most is your income. For a while, for the heck of it, check that you make more than $1 million a year and watch the kind of mail you get. Then check you make under $5,000 a year and your mailbox will be empty.
Find out how other people live.
Don's exactly right with warranty cards. All you need is the receipt. You can throw away the warranty card if you don't want your information shared. If you want to, the experiment Don used is called, we call seeding, and you could try it at your own home by using different middle initials, et cetera, to see what kind of different mail you get from filling out different kinds of cards if you're interested.
And I should note that, Minnesota Public Radio does not share its membership list with any partisan political organization. We allow members to block their names from being exchanged with anybody. On our website, we don't collect personally identifying information unless you choose to provide that information. Well, lots of things to talk about. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us this hour. Appreciate it. And
Thank you. I encourage people to go to our website as well, opt out of their list.
Okay, thanks so much. Thank Ari Schwartz, policy analyst for the Center for Democracy and Technology, and also with us, Don Ray, who is a Los Angeles-based author and independent journalist. Web site links can be found at Minnesota Public Radio, NPR.org, and then check Surveillance Society. We've got programs all week long on this subject. Reminder that, as you've heard over and over again, more money in less time. We sure like to thank you for helping us prove that it works. Because of your generous contributions, we reached our goal for the fall membership drive in record time. If you signed up on our Easy Pay plan, we'll be sending you an enrollment form in the mail very soon. Because of your gift, we can continue to make more great radio. We thank you very much for pledges last week.